This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans. Former Kalamazoo City Commissioner turned California cattle farmer and author Nicolette Hahn Nyman will be back at Western Michigan University on October 12th. Coming up, she talks with Andy Robbins about eating meat and dairy and the treatment of farm animals. But first, a new director began work at the Kalamazoo Public Library this summer. Ryan Weber previously served as director of the Van Buren District Library, and before that, the Otsego District Library. In August, he began work as the director of the Kalamazoo Public Library. Ryan Weber, thank you for being with us.
You're welcome, and it's great to be here.
So tell us a little bit about yourself. Where did you grow up?
Sure. I grew up in Lansing. My family is originally from the Clinton County area. I have a lot of family in St. John's, and even before then, folks came from Westphalia and Fowler area.
And where'd you go to college?
I attended Lansing Community College for a couple years, and then I transferred to Western Michigan, where I got a degree in public history, and then discovered that I couldn't get a job or the career path that I wanted with just my degree in public history, but I was motivated at archival work and found out that if I got a library science degree, I could further enhance my future career and look towards a path that would lead me to museum work or archives work. So I went to Wayne State and got a library science degree.
At what point did you figure out that actually what you wanted to do was work at libraries?
Well, I have to admit, it wasn't working in a public library that kind of led me to this field. It was that track of getting my archival administration background and education at a library science program. And in Wayne State and the U of M here in Michigan both have great programs that develop that interest for people. And I started out my career working at the Detroit Institute of Arts as a librarian, but it was in a special library, and there was a lot of work in archives, archival management there. And then that led me to Cranbrook Educational Community in Bloomfield Hills, where I was an archivist there for a few years. But what happened was our family was growing. My wife and I, we were expecting our third child. And at that point, we were far from home, far from Lansing, or my wife is from the Kalamazoo area. And we wanted to get back over to this side of the state. And I decided at that point, and that was in the winter of 1999. And I remember that winter very well because it was a bad one in terms of storms and heavy snow, and living over on the east side of the state, we just all of a sudden we were wishing to come back and be closer to family. So at that point, I was ready to take any job, and I started looking at library jobs and soon discovered that the Otsego District Library was looking for a new director. And I applied, I got that job, and my first day working there as director was my first day working in a public library.
I think people will find it interesting that a harsh winter got you to move to West Michigan, where the winters actually tend to be a little bit harsher.
That's true. I hadn't thought of that. But yeah, that was one of the components that drove us to want to come home, was the repercussions of that particular winter and the fact that our third child was on its way.
So do you see similarities in being a director where you have been Van Buren District Library, Otsego District Library, and Kalamazoo Public Library? I mean, how much is being a library director a portable sort of skill that you can take from one place to another?
Well, I think it is a portable skill, but I mean, at the root of what we do, we serve our communities, and we're trying to provide a basic need for many people and a recreational need for others. But at the heart of what we do is we're trying to provide the best service for our community, no matter where that's at, whether you're in a mixed rural and suburb kind of community like Otsego, or more of a very rural community like Van Buren County in many cases. And then when you come to Kalamazoo, hey, it's a little bit different ballgame in terms of makeup and population, but we're still working hard and trying to do our best to make sure that we meet the needs of everyone who lives within the entire community.
And so how do you see it being different in Kalamazoo? What do you think that the library does here that may be a little different from what it's done in Otsego or at the Van Buren District Library?
Sure. Well, what I love about Kalamazoo is our tremendous outreach to the community. We have an incredible pool of talent on our staff. We have staff members who feel that need to make inroads to their neighborhoods, to their communities, and not only show them what libraries can do, but look to residents and community members and understand where they're coming from, their life perspective. And, you know, whether it's library programming or a diversity of collections, I think we work really hard at the Kalamazoo Public Library to be more than just a public library in the sense that we're providing more than just books, but looking at where folks are coming from.
Your background, as you mentioned, is in history, and I wonder if you see public libraries playing a maybe larger role in preserving local history and kind of keeping that record of what has happened in a community.
Yeah, and maybe you know, maybe you don't, but we have an excellent resource at the Kalamazoo Public Library, our local history department, named after the Clarence Miller family, is a tremendous resource. And it's known widely, not just here in Southwest Michigan, but I believe across the Midwest and even the country, in terms of, again, our staffing and the history behind how that all came about. And in terms of, you know, we have a wonderful historical legacy here in Kalamazoo and Kalamazoo County, and being closely associated with a university environment, we have a lot of records and a lot of families who have contributed to the local history collections here at the Kalamazoo Public Library. But our resource on the second floor at the downtown central branch is used quite a bit, and it's not only something that you can use in person, but it receives heavy usage on our website.
Are libraries adapting right now and changing in much the same way that media organizations like this one are having to adapt and change, perhaps because people's habits are moving in different directions when it comes to how they take in and process information, you know, digital media and social media, et cetera?
Well, absolutely. And I mentioned this briefly a minute ago, but the idea that public libraries traditionally are a place where people walk into or drive to in order to check out a book. That still happens, of course, and we still love it when folks do that. But more and more, year by year, month by month, that changes in the sense that more folks are more mobile. They seem to be busier, and they need that convenience. They need that convenience of accessing something online. Books are always going to be important. Our circulation of print books continues to go down every year, but at the same time, our patrons' reliance on digital materials and downloadable books or audiobooks or even movies and music continues to rise. And that's where we see a lot of the adaptation or reliance on what we provide in terms of collections. That's where that change is taking place. But on another level, and I mentioned this too earlier, the fact that we don't just sit back and wait for people to come in. We have to be out there more. We have so many outreach efforts in order not to make sure that the library is a busy place or a relevant place, but we feel obliged to assist families and schools and neighborhoods, not only be aware of what we have, but improve literacy efforts. We believe that getting books into the hands of kids, especially from birth to five, is such an important thing. And it's for the development of the brain and for getting kids prepared by the time they reach school, that they're at an even playing level. And we believe that libraries, the Kalamazoo Public Library, has a big role in that.
Do you see, and I know there's this sort of general belief that you might hear shared from time to time that people just really don't read anymore. As someone who's in the library universe, are people still reading and maybe doing it in some different ways?
Oh, definitely. I think people still love books. They still enjoy reading. I think what we're seeing, though, is, again, because of the advancement of technology and the ease and convenience that our mobile devices have, that does have a serious effect on especially younger people growing up in this digital age where the idea of coming into a building to check out a book and then to sit there patiently, read that book and turn page by page is not only difficult, but for many, a foreign idea. So that is something that we will constantly be struggling with as we move forward. But it gives us the motivation and that challenge to make a difference and to show young families and kids why it's important not only to hold a book, but at least to make sure that we're still reading, and not only reading for homework or reading for purpose of accomplishing an assignment, but reading for pleasure. That's where we learn. That's where we not only learn about the world, but we learn how to enjoy life around us, to take the time and to turn a page and read a book.
If we're looking at the future of public libraries, do you have a sense of what the next big thing is?
Yeah, I think that it's still important for us to make sure that we reach as many people as possible. Where our library system here in Kalamazoo is well supported, not only through our residents' taxpayer dollars, but I hear every day from patrons, people I meet, colleagues, how well folks love their Kalamazoo Public Library. But we know we're not reaching everybody. We know that there are still a lot of people who would never consider coming into one of our branches. And to me, that's a big motivator. And we need to work on removing barriers as well. There are still a lot of reasons why those families don't step foot in the library, whether it's cultural or language differences or the fear of owing money, you know, large sums of money if they have outstanding long-term fine balances. We need to find ways to convince our local residents why it's important that we see them back in the library, because we want them in the library, and we're a welcoming place.
So does that mean once in a while granting an amnesty on fines that are owed, or maybe some sort of an agreement to make it more affordable?
We are always willing to work out overdue fines and to work with families. And yes, we're always looking at ways to remove those barriers, even when it comes to financial barriers.
Now, you've also mentioned a couple times there are taxpayer dollars that go to support this. The Kalamazoo Gazette recently wrote about how the court fines that are levied go to libraries. And you were quoted in the story saying that that's, you know, a source of funding you do rely on. And I guess that just made me think about the whole financial system of public libraries. Is it stable going forward? Do you have to keep re-examining that as well?
Yeah, I think with any governmental unit, the library, the district library, is a unit of government, and we rely heavily. I think in Kalamazoo, it's about 80 to 85% of our revenue comes from tax dollars. So we don't have a millage in perpetuity. It's a millage that is renewed. We have a couple of them that go, I believe, for 10 years or so. And when those come up for renewal, we have to prove continually to our taxpayers the value of the library and why they should support a new millage. But yes, we also rely on penal fines. Penal fines are those traffic tickets that folks get if there's a traffic infraction. Then part of that goes to the courts and part of that goes to the libraries, and that goes way back to our state constitution, and it's an old and reliable method of library funding. But legislatively, there are always pulls and tugs from other outside agencies or groups that try to take that away from libraries, and we're always fighting to make sure that we can retain that and keep library funding at least at a consistent level and a predictable level. But it's always the library's jobs and the library board's jobs to make sure that we're spending wisely and providing what our community wants.
Ryan Weber is the director of the Kalamazoo Public Library. He started that job on August 1st. Thank you very much for your time.
Thank you.
This is WMUK's West Southwest. These days, the meat and dairy products on your table probably come from a densely packed factory farm. But former Kalamazoo City Commissioner Nicolette Hahn-Nyman says it wasn't always so. Now a cattle rancher in California, she's written two books about the complicated relationship between humans and farm animals. and she'll speak about that history next week at Western Michigan University. Han Nyman gave WMUK's Andy Robbins a preview.
You've written two books now about our relationship with the animals that end up on our plate, at least those of us who are not vegetarian or vegan. And you're going to be talking about those animals from prehistory to modernity, which is quite a long span. So I would assume there have been quite a few changes.
Yes. Well, it's going to be obviously sort of a brief overview of that historic period, but I think it's really important and valuable to take a step back and look at that long-term trajectory, both in terms of the human-animal relationship and in terms of the ecological impact of those animals on the Earth, because I actually think we really need that longer-term perspective in our modern-day conversation. And I like going way back to, you know, sort of the Ice Age, basically, and going forward, because what the Earth looks like today is determined by that long-term history.
So how does our relationship with animals change the face of the Earth?
In the Pleistocene period, we had this very long period of time where you had the development of large herds of large animals, herds and packs. And so you had, it was really the beginning of the creation of major grassland areas on the Earth. There's this very detailed, you know, sort of archaeological record about when grass first appeared and then when it became more widespread. But the interesting thing about grass is that it doesn't really exist in large areas until you have this sort of co-evolution that's happening with the animals that live on grass and thrive on grass and maintain those grassy areas. And those are the grazing animals. And so you end up having for tens of millions of years during this period, you have these huge herds of grazing animals, and then you have the development of large predatory packs of animals that basically hunt them, keep them moving, keep their numbers in check, et cetera. And all of, you know, all the plants, all of the, you know, microbiology, all of the macrofauna, everything was developing under those conditions for tens of millions of years. Then, you know, sort of fast forwarding to, you know, let's say 10,000 years ago, well, about 12,000 years ago was the development of agriculture, and that had a huge impact on human populations and our relationship with animals as well. There was already the domestication of animals that had begun probably 30,000 years ago or so, but there became much more domestication of plants and animals, and the relationship shifted quite a bit at that point. But animals remained absolutely essential to human survival because we were, you know, as we went into parts of the world where you couldn't really grow crops, the animals were absolutely essential in converting that grass that humans can't eat into meat and milk. And animals were mobile, and animals, unlike crops, are something that can provide food in the form of milk, but then also can be slaughtered when necessary. And there's flexibility to that, unlike crops, which cannot be moved around and have to be harvested at a certain time. So there was this unbelievably important relationship between humans and the domesticated animals that started when agriculture started and as humans covered more and more of the globe. And I think nowadays, you know, what I've written about a lot is the way that we're farming, the sort of the modern day method of farming, which is the much more industrialized approach. This is very recent in this long trajectory because it's really only about the last 50 years. And what I've been writing my books about is how this incredibly important ecological role that animals have played all this time, and then this incredibly important role they've played for humans specifically, has sort of been radically altered by this industrial approach that is being taken with modern animal farming. And so my sort of basic argument is that the animals are valuable and important, and that it's good for humans to have them in the food system, but it's wrong for us to raise them in, you know, factory type settings.
Given, you know, the population pressure with human populations growing around the world, is it likely that the industrial approach to agriculture and animals in particular is likely to change anytime soon.
People often assume that the rising population, you know, makes the industrial approach. In fact, this the argument that agriculture makes all the time is it makes it imperative that we raise animals this way. And my argument is kind of exactly the opposite. I feel that the tremendous ecological stress that the planet is experiencing right now is a mandate that we shift the way we're, you know, doing really all agriculture, because it's very chemical dependent, which is not just polluting, but is killing the life in our soils, which is the foundation of sustainable agriculture. Our ability to feed ourselves, you know, indefinitely into the future, I think, is absolutely tied to our ability to keep our soils healthy and alive. So I think we need to rebuild our whole agricultural system, not just with respect to the animals. But with respect to the animals, it is incredibly important that we sort of harness what's so beneficial and good about the animals in the way we raise food, because they add enormous benefits to the fertility of the soil, the life of the soil, and 40% of the Earth's land surface is not farmable, but it is characterized as range lands that can be grazed. And actually, a lot of that land is grazed right now. And when that's done well, that has ecological benefits for the climate, for the, you know, for the hydrological cycles, the way the water cycles through our whole system. And it produces food in places where we cannot otherwise produce food. So I think the role of the animals is more important now than ever. But I think we need to do things in quite a radically different way than we're doing them now.
And how would that change? I mean, what kind of approach do you think should be taken?
You know, there's a huge portion of the animals that are raised for food that are grazing animals. So, you know, my sort of primary passion these last few years has been this defense of cattle. Defending Beef is my last book. And the reason is because, you know, this 40% of the land surface that cannot be used for anything other than grazing as far as food production is concerned, when that's done well, that basically plays the role, it substitutes for those disappeared wild grazing herds that once covered so much of the earth in the Pleistocene period I was talking about a few minutes ago. When you do it badly, you cause damage to the soils and to the waters and everything. So it's sort of urgently necessary that we manage those herds well, but it's also really important that we have those herds out on the grass. So, for example, dairy production in the United States now is very barely connected with grass anymore. It's much more about grain and soy and other, you know, sort of harvested crops that are grown in one place and shipped long distances to the animals. I think a truly sustainable system is one where we use those grazing animals on the grasslands where they belong, and the use of sort of grains and soys and other harvested crops is really minimal. And we raise the crops that are raised, you know, that are sort of grown and harvested are for humans, and the crops, the grass, the vegetation that just naturally covers the earth is harvested by the animals directly. So one of the urgent things I think we need to do is get the grazing animals back out onto the grasslands. And at the same time, we have to dramatically improve the way the grazing is taking place. But you don't throw the baby out with the bathwater. You know, there's a lot of talk nowadays about sort of getting rid of the animals in the food system. I am convinced, after studying this for the last nearly two decades, that if you eliminate the animals from the food system, not that I think this is even possible, but if you did wave a magic wand and make that happen, you would cause dramatic ecological decline to the earth by doing that.
How is this going to stack up if this approach that you've been talking about were taken? How would that stack up cost-wise, since price is a definite consideration when you're thinking about food?
Well, it sort of depends if you eliminate the market distortion. So a lot of what's happened in the United States over the last 100 years or so is that agriculture has moved in a direction that government has subsidized it to move into. And one thing we know for sure is that, for example, fossil fuel prices are unstable, and they're projected to be more and more unstable and to continuously rise as fossil fuel resources decline, the entire system right now that we have for food production is really heavily dependent on the low cost of oil. You know, and as that changes, I think we're going to see the need to move away from this really chemical dependent agriculture, because the chemicals are all based on fossil fuel production. And of course, the machinery is directly based on fossil fuel. Fossil fuel production is important for chemicals because it is used as a feedstock directly to create the chemicals, and it is also fuel intensive to generate the chemicals. So just to clarify that point, but also the machinery that modern agriculture is dependent on is very fossil fuel dependent. And almost all of the modern, the major crops that are grown, in, especially like the middle part of the country, of which Michigan is a part, are very dependent on the subsidy of the government subsidy of the growth of those crops, the commodity crops. And if we don't have those kind of subsidies in the system, then it makes the raising of the animals on grass a lot less. It is more expensive now because of the cost of land. But if you took away the subsidies for the commodity crops that are fed to the confined animals, it would shift the economics quite a bit, and the cost would not be much more. So there's sort of a lot of bigger picture issues here that come into play. But I think the long-term sustainability and affordability of food really is tied to this sort of making the system truly sustainable and regenerative over the long term.
You mentioned that people have, you know, domesticated animals for tens of thousands of years, and the reason that was done was, you know, very practical, survival. But do you think that, you know, in the modern era, that our attitude towards farm animals in particular has become too utilitarian? In other words, they have no value beyond what they can do for us.
Yeah, I mean, I'm a staunch critic of the industrial approach towards raising animals for food. And I feel very strongly that the sort of industrial approach just really doesn't apply, should never have been applied to the raising of animals, because it turns living sentient creatures into production units. We're treating them as, you know, widgets. And there's no doubt in my mind, from having been to a lot of these places and having, you know, studied it for a long time now and seen a lot of video footage in addition to the places I've seen in person, that this is not an acceptable way to raise animals. To me, the moral obligation to animals is not fulfilled when they're living in an industrial confinement type setting. But when it's on a good farm with high welfare standards, I think that the moral obligation of the animal is absolutely fulfilled, and it provides great benefits to humans to have those animals.
Nicolette Hahn-Nyman spoke with WMUK's Andy Robbins. She'll give the 2017 Hamner Lecture, sponsored by Western Michigan University's History Department, next Thursday, October 12th. It begins at 6:45 that evening in Kirsch Auditorium. A programming note, on Monday morning at 9 o'clock, we will bring you a forum for candidates running for Portage Mayor and City Council. It was recorded Wednesday at the Portage District Library. It can also be heard at 7 o'clock Monday night. At 3:30 Monday afternoon, we will have a rebroadcast of our interview with Michelle Miller Adams and Michael Moody of Grand Valley State University on their study about the different philanthropic cultures in Kalamazoo and Grand Rapids. This is WMUK's West Southwest. I'm Gordon Evans.